This is the Marketplace Morning Report. I'm Ben Johnson. The Alton Brown, or as his business card says, Mastermind Alton Brown. Thanks for joining us.
I am glad to be here.
So first, I want to talk to you about your live tours.
Yes.
How are the Alton Brown live tours different from your average superstar rock and roll band live tours?
No difference whatsoever. No, there is a good bit of difference. It is basically it's a 100-minute culinary variety show.
Okay.
There are large, strange food demonstrations.
Okay.
Some of which are very messy. Some of which are kind of scary, and all of them educational.
Messy and scary is what, you know, that's what food is supposed to be.
You know,
right?
It is theater, first and foremost. So I guess I should call it culinary theater.
Okay.
But my live show has a couple of very large format and very, let's put it this way, food demonstrations of unusual size that people have never seen before.
Okay.
There's some multimedia aspects. I actually am doing a version of a lecture, although lecture is a scary word, that I've been doing for years now called 10 Things I'm Pretty Sure I'm Sure About Food, which is kind of a multimedia stand-up thing I do.
Okay.
I'm traveling with my trio. We're going to be performing 5 or 6 of my food songs live on stage.
Oh, that sounds good.
Yeah. And these are songs ranging across a wide spectrum of style, from punk to country to some other things. And they
Can
are,
you give me a sample?
I'll give you a sample of some titles.
Yeah, yeah.
One of my favorites, a country song about love gone bad called Airport Shrimp Cocktail. It's about getting food poisoning at an airport and what happens on the plane afterwards. There's kind of a big kind of Johnny Cash style anthem called TV Chef, which is a scathing satire about my industry and how freaking ridiculous it is. There is a hardcore Delta Blues song called Pork Chop Blues, which is about a guy that has to put up with his wife's bad pork chops.
Ooh. Okay.
There's a funny.
That's the
funky
country. That's for the country crowd.
No, that's straightforward blues.
Straightforward blues. Okay.
There's a hard driving punk number called Easy Bake Oven, and there's a lullaby called Cooking Lesson Lullaby Part 1 that was written for my daughter when she was about 5, which was supposed to be about how easy cooking is, but actually turned into an ode to how freaking complicated cooking is. That's a small smattering of the musical offerings that
sounds good.
That will be up. So there's a lot that goes on in the show, and then there's a big kind of open question and answer session, and there are filmed elements involving a lot of puppets because my fans tend to be very into puppets, especially puppets that are portraying yeasts.
Yeah.
There's gonna be a lot of yeast puppets. There's gonna be a lot of burping and farting yeasts, and music and big strange food demonstrations. It's pretty much the best thing you could do with $50 or $60 that I could think of. Actually, I have no idea how much tickets are.
Yeah, it's I would. That sounds not only equal to, but probably better than your average U2 or Pink Floyd tour.
Yeah, without a doubt. Those big traveling shows, they got nothing. Okay, absolutely not. But in all seriousness, what I wanted to do was attempt to reinvent or push the idea of what a live culinary show could do. And that if you were like, well, I like food and I'm interested in food, how could I turn that into, you know, a 100-minute or a 2-act live stage show that would be interesting and funny and educational all at the same time? I like reinventing forms. And interestingly enough, I mean, the real reason I'm doing this is because I actually have a degree. My college degree was in theater. And, of course, my parents said that it would never be worth a damn. So I'm mostly doing this to get back at them.
I think this is really interesting because, you know, is this the format that you are happiest in? I mean, you do so many different kinds of things, but you speak about it as if it's something that is a, you know.
Live stage performing is a great deal of fun. I've done a lot of it over the last 10 years, but never in a traveling roadshow format. It's always been here and there.
Okay.
And it's great fun because unlike being in front of a TV camera, which gives you absolutely nothing, in fact, it sucks out your soul a little bit at a time, audiences actually do bring something to the party. And they do energize you, and they tend to give just as much as you do, sometimes more. And that's that's great. That's a great deal of fun. And there is a buzz that comes from a live performance, from stepping out on a stage with 2,000 people expecting something. That is a rush.
Absolutely. I want to ask you about fake chicken nuggets. I have recently been eating them and have been amazed at how realistic they are. And you kind of touched on this in a Wired piece that you did relatively recently, correct?
Oh, the one that's in the recent food issue.
Yeah. So where are we with the technology of approximating meat?
Well, now, it depends on the meat. You know, it's some meat is much, 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 much more difficult than others.
Okay.
Making an analog fish product or an analog chicken product is a very, very different thing from trying to make beef. Beef is way more complicated and far more difficult to do, and I'm not sure worth it, because, you know, one of the things that happens when you start making meat is you start downgrading kind of the importance of what the animal has to give. Mm. And I would rather, in the case of beef, for instance, I would rather us concentrate on being nicer to cows before we eat them. But chicken, we've kind of already lost the battle, because we've already turned chickens into factory pieces. We've already de-animalized the chicken to a point where it just doesn't make sense anymore. So for me, I'd rather eat a really good roast chicken a couple of times a month and then eat something that's a chicken analog the rest of the time, because the truth is we just – we've already removed most of the flavor from them anyway. They are manufactured things now.
That is so true. And by and large, whenever I've sort of been a little bit self-aware about realizing that I don't like sometimes when I'm eating chicken and there's bones in it, and I'm expecting there not to be bones in it.
Yeah, but see, there ought to be, because you're eating an animal.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and you should be reminded of eating an animal.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, I like heads on plates. I want my food looking at me to remind me, hey, I died here, okay? And the fact that Americans, you know, we wouldn't even eat fish with heads on it because we don't want to be reminded that there was a life involved is just kind of, you know, bullshit.
Yeah, I agree. You have a test kitchen in Atlanta?
I do.
What goes on there? What do you test there?
Food, mostly. I mean, we develop a lot of recipes.
Okay.
And we do a lot of food experiments. So, in fact, I'm just finishing a new one. We just built a new complex with two big test kitchens and a studio for shooting our new stuff that we're doing for digital. And, you know, part of that is really more set up like a lab to try out new technologies and new ingredients and you know, test things. Mm. So that part of the kitchen is more lab, and it's more set up for experimentation than recipe testing per se.
Give me an example of a new technology that you're going to be testing.
We're paying a lot of attention to ultrasonics right now.
Okay.
We're playing around a lot with all different forms of ultrasonic treatments on food. It's interesting. It's a relatively new thing for me to be messing with. It changes, let's just say that with the physics that are involved with ultrasonics, a lot of things become possible that aren't.
Okay.
Whether it's extraction of flavanols from wood chips or creating whole new types of emulsions or other kind of, you know, breaking down of starches and whatnot. So we're messing around with that stuff a lot. The problem is that the equipment's expensive, so we're kind of piecemealing it. We're also doing a good deal of room temperature or cold distillations using zero atmosphere or low reduced atmosphere systems like roto evaporators and things like that.
Whoa.
Which allow you to make, you know, brandy from cider or other things like that. But they also allow you to concentrate flavors from things down, kind of distilling flavors down to their most pure core, you know, whether it's herb combinations or things like that. So it's a distilling process. It's kind of stuff that's been done in the perfume industry for a really long time, but we're now applying it to food. And there are some good devices for doing that now that are a little bit cheaper. You know, it used to cost $100,000 to get into that end of things, and now it's significantly cheaper, or else I wouldn't be doing it.
Do you?
And we tinker around a lot with digital controlled cooking baths. You know what the industry likes to call sous vide, even though that's a misnomer.
Huh.
But we're trying to develop some new systems on that as well. Working on some systems that would allow an iPhone app to run a controlled digital water bath system.
Whoa.
Little things like that.
So I know I get the impression that in your average kitchen, you're a fan of kitchen technology that's multitasking, that doesn't just do one job.
Correct.
Is that right?
Absolutely.
Tell me about some of your favorite items.
I'm a really big fan of my panini press.
Okay.
Now, it's funny how a lot of people will get, you know, it was a big kind of panini craze a couple of years ago. And panini presses, some pretty high quality panini presses from ordinary companies like Krups, Cuisinart, people like that.
Uh-huh.
Came out with panini presses. And I now find that I can't, or don't choose, to live without mine. But I never make paninis in it. Ever.
So what do you make? What do you do?
Other crap. I put, let me tell you something. Give me a Cornish hen.
Okay.
I will cut the back out of the Cornish hen and butterfly it, salt and pepper it, throw it in a panini press, put a big can of tomatoes on top as a weight, and it will be perfectly done in 12 minutes.
Wow.
With perfectly crisp skin. And then there's a bunch of fat in there. So I'll throw a bunch of mushrooms in the panini press, slam the lid, and those mushrooms will cook in that chicken fat to perfection in about 4 minutes. So I do whole meals based on this freaking panini press, which most people only use as a panini press because panini's the first name. And that's one of the problems with the culinary world is that we tend to limit things to what they're kind of named to do. You know, I don't know the last time I made a panini. I don't guess I like paninis that much, but I sure do like my panini press.
So what is it about the press that is so useful to you? Is it an even distribution of heat and consistent, or what is it?
It's all side searing. Here's the thing. You put something in a pan on a cooktop.
Yep.
You're searing or getting that direct conductive heat from one side.
Right.
Well, a good panini press allows you to do that on two sides. That way you've got heat coming in from two different sides on the food at the same time, which speeds the cooking considerably, which reduces moisture loss considerably.
Okay.
So why would I roast something in the oven if I could slam it, I could put it in a panini press?
You could just smash it in a press.
It makes more sense. I put whole fish in there. I put all kinds of things in there.
Wow.
I mean, I will put in there almost anything that I can get into a semi-flat state.
Tell me, you obviously have a broad depth of knowledge in terms of the history of cooking as well. Can you tell me what, you know, one of the questions I want to ask you is what your top four technological innovations in the history of human culinary existence, what are they?
Well, it's hard to play down fire.
That's good.
Learning to use fire, pretty big, pretty much the birth of cooking.
Yep.
The development of modern ovens, which is relatively recently. The oven went through, you know, in 18th century France was still being run, was pretty much just a charcoal-driven system. But then we got into truly, you know, we got into real ovens, actual ovens, in the 19th century. And the development of the wood-burning, freestanding oven was a pretty big deal, or stove.
And that's what you mean when you say modern, wood-burning, freestanding?
Yeah, I mean a modern, meaning that it stood on legs, it was made of iron, it had a flue. It was relatively controllable. Once we started by using dampers, once we got into a natural gas oven, then we were really in the modern age because now we could control, you could say, okay, I would like for this oven cavity to be somewhere in the range of 300 degrees, 350 degrees. And let's face it, most American ovens today can be made with one setting, 350. It's 90% of the recipes written on planet Earth are for that.
Sure.
Now, this was, if you look back in the history of the oven, which is a project that I'm actually doing right now, you can look at, it wasn't one big advance or several advances that kind of built on each other, especially during the Industrial Revolution. But that would be a big one.
Okay.
The invention of refrigeration, moving from ice-based refrigeration to mechanical refrigeration, the invention of the condenser refrigerant system that we have now,
okay,
which is really less than 100 years old, huge, you know, not having to harvest ice. Now we can actually make ice.
And is that, once again, sort of an issue of consistency, just sort of a consistent temperature?
Well, the fact that you can plug it into a wall. I mean, you know, my mother, who's 75 years old, very much remembers deliveries from the Iceman.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, that was a harvested, you know, ice was harvested as an agricultural product up until fairly recently, and then it became a manufactured product, but we were still dependent on getting that, you know, receiving that into our house and putting it into an ice box. And then with the kind of big boom of electrical appliances that took off in the beginning of the 20th century, we got electric, well, they're natural gas, actually, were some of the first refrigerators. Were run by natural gas, and then we got electric refrigerators. And the invention of electric refrigeration and the idea that you've got a compressor that compresses a refrigerant, whether it was something incredibly dangerous like ammonia,
uh-huh,
or like the various forms of Freon that we have now, or Freon derivatives, derivatives, mm-hmm, that, you know, allow us to take advantage of the fact that a compressed gas, when released into a controlled space, absorbs heat.
Sure. You know,
it's the whole, it's called the Joules-Thomson effect. And that made the safe modern food system that we enjoy today possible, refrigeration. The other one, the last one that I would put on the list, it's really difficult to overstate the importance of the microwave oven. And the invention of the microwave, it was really the first new heat that we invented. We invented a kind of heat.
Right.
You know, this idea that you could oscillate a polar molecule with the correct frequency of microwaves and create heat through that movement. That was new.
And it's interesting what it does to moisture, too, right?
Moisture is what it heats.
Right.
Primarily. This is taking advantage, you know, microwaves take advantage of the fact that water is an incredibly polar molecule.
Right.
You know, it's an oxygen with some hydrogens that are mounted in a way makes it look like it's wearing a Disneyland hat. some fats have these polar structures, but primarily it's water. And water is the most abundant compound in food. And that's what allows us to be able to microwave food. But we still have not even begun to touch on what microwaves can actually do. And the reason for that is that, especially in America, we got all the frickin' natural gas we want.
Yep.
And one of the things that prevents us from moving forward with kitchen technologies, like, for instance, induction cooktops, which I'm a huge fan of, is that gas is cheap. You know, natural gas is, it's like, you know, oil in Saudi Arabia. You know, we don't have a reason to move into another fuel.
Yep.
So gas stays the standard of our industry, unless, of course, you're a chef in New York City with a little bitty restaurant, and you use all the induction you can get your hands on.
Yep. Huh. So is there a technology that doesn't exist that you yearn for? I mean, is it now just a process of experimentation, or is there something that you wake up every once in a while and in the morning and say, you know what I really wish I had that it hasn't been created yet?
The big one. Well, we're on the cusp of it. I'm a child of the 60s.
Okay.
And so the overarching, there are two pieces of overarching technology that I yearned for since youth.
Okay.
One was a jetpack.
I think we all yearned for that, whether or not we're a child of 60s.
You know, but you know what? I'm a pilot and I have an airplane, so I'm okay. I'll stick with that for now. I'm still a little pissed off about it, but I understand it's a challenge because we haven't had that yet. The other one was the Star Trek food replicator.
Oh.
Now,
yes.
As we move into the realm of 3D printing,
yep,
the very real possibility exists for us to print our own food and design our own food from a series of chemicals. Do I think we should replace steak with an amino acid analog printed out by a MakerBot? No, that's not what I'm suggesting. But I'm suggesting that there are a lot of things we can do and a lot of things that we could do and probably should do. For instance, if I could, and trust me, this is something that people are working on right now, if I could dump 100,000 cockroaches into a blender and have it come out in a stick that I could then feed into a 3D printer, recalibrate the enzymes, recalibrate all those amino acids, and make myself a quiche, why the hell wouldn't I do that?
You and my dad are in the same boat on this, although I've recently...
Well, smart guy, your dad.
Yeah.
You're saying that there's so much out there that can be made into food. We just need the right machinery to do it for us.
And make it palatable.
To make it palatable and to make it nutritionally viable. Just because you've got the right building blocks for the human body to work with, that they actually have to be put together in the correct order. And they have to be put together in a certain way. You can't redesign the human genome overnight to suit what technology can do. We have to be able to imitate what you know, our systems that exist that our body want. But I do think that with a combination of what we're learning from sequencing everything from genomes to, you know, building new amino compounds, that there is a very real possibility that within certainly my daughter's lifetime, she might be able to make up brand new foods and print them out.
And there, as you sort of note, there are a lot of reasons to be pushing in this direction, right? I mean,
there are. I mean, we got a lot of people on this marble here, and we don't actually, you know, what we're doing to the planet in order to produce food for them all is a problem.
Yep.
It's not only a problem from an environmental standpoint, economic problems, huge economic problems. Matter of fact, I would say that the power structures and economic structures that are going to shape our future history, as it were, over the next 20, 25 years will certainly be based on food and water, food and water. So it makes sense that we would do this. Unfortunately, you know, a lot of the places that are doing top research on this are unfortunately still governmental. There's not enough private money going into this stuff because private money is always looking for a return that's fast. And I'm, you know, that kind of doesn't make much sense, you know, but that's just kind of the nature of the world. I do think that it's possible, and it's possible within, if not our lifetime, then the lifetime of our kids.
Well, I'm remembering the episode of Good Eats that you did about crawfish, I think, right?
Yes.
And sort of just the possibilities of that as a sort of, I don't know, a shellfish crop. I'm not sure what one would call it, but...
Well, the thing about crawfish is it's amazingly smart. Amazingly sustainable.
Yep.
And a great use of land and a great use of water and a great use of everything. I mean, it's an ideal product for where it is raised. I think we should eat a lot more of that. We should also be adapting our palates to food that there's lots of. I often call my culinary fixation with squid to be my war on squid, because I'm certain that squid are going to take over the planet if we don't eat more of them.
That's going to be on the gravestone?
Should eat more squid.
He was always yelling about squid.
Yeah. they're an alien race, and they will take over. They're smart. They're evolving. They're moving into places they shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, they're invasive, and they're almost 100% protein. Eat more squid. You love planet Earth, eat more squid. Lay off cows for a year and eat all the squid you can hold. Be a much better place.
Interesting. So
I'm looking for a food replicator that I can pump squid into.
Squid and cockroaches.
I'm going to load a 100-ton block of frozen squid into my replicator, and I'm just going to make whatever I want. That's the dream.
Do you... You know, you've mentioned a few times here, you sort of hinted at the... some issues within the food television industry. Are you...
Which, by the way, I'm part of.
Yes. And that's why I want to ask you, you know, you've hinted at this a couple times in our conversation. What are the problems?
there's almost always an issue at the nexus of entertainment and information.
Okay.
And I'm throwing around the word nexus like I know what it really means. Nobody does. crux, whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
Where the sharp little pointy sticks meet, there's almost always going to be a problem. Nothing is more potent than the transference of cooking know-how between people. It's one of the things that holds up culture.
Yep.
When you start turning it into an entertainment, there are always going to be issues.
Okay.
There are. I'm not saying that food media is making problems.
Okay.
But I think that an industry like the one I'm in needs to constantly poke itself with a stick.
Mm-hmm.
To keep everybody kind of mindful of what the hell's going on here. And I say this greatly because of what I've seen in people coming out of culinary schools in the last year, last few years, which is that it used to be you went to culinary school to learn how to cook. Now you go to culinary school to be a TV star.
Aha.
And a lot of chefs start forgetting what it is they do because now they're big, powerful TV stars. The best chefs will always just say, look, I'm a cook. And a chef with a TV show who's still got his head together will say, look, I'm a cook that got really lucky and I got a TV show and I'm not going to lose my mind here. But a lot of people do lose their minds. You know,
hard not to.
Chefs have become cultural, you know, superstars.
Yeah.
And I feel like I'm kind of in a different place to say that because I was in the film business first.
Mm-hmm.
And then I left and went to culinary school so that I could do what I do. But I'm always... I'm not a member of the club, so to speak. You know, I mean, I don't have Gordon Ramsay on speed dial here or anything, you know.
Right.
So I do think that the industry needs to not take itself so seriously. We should poke fun at ourselves often, which is hopefully something that I don't forget to do.
Sure.
And you know, when I close the closing number of my show, this song TV Chef is pretty... hopefully it's funny, but it points up the fact that, hey, this is kind of silly, you know, that we've made people that know how to cook into rock stars. But it's also important to see why did that happen? How did that happen? And isn't that kind of, to me, the most culturally interesting phenomenon of the last 40 years?
Culinary guru Alton Brown. Thanks, man.
It was nice talking to you, man. Pleasure.